Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Heather Dune McAdam, author of the new book 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Transport to Auschwitz. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2Jewish.
Shalom. There's been a tendency in the American Jewish community for quite a while now to talk about how we are in a post-denominational world, one in which Jews no longer consider themselves to be Orthodox, Conservative, or Reform Jews, or even Reconstructionist or Renewal Jews, but simply people living in a free society in which Jewish identity is a construct of their own making, in which each person gets to decide just what he or she wants his own Judaism to be. The truth is that we've actually been doing this for an awfully long time in the U.S., deciding not only what branch or stream of Judaism we wish to be in, but how often and in what ways we'll be active, whether we wish to participate at all in organized Jewish life. In the same way that American Jews have been intermarrying, that is, marrying non-Jews in higher and higher proportions, we've also been doing what we personally wish to do about our own Jewish involvement and practice in every aspect of our lives. Or we have simply chosen not to regularly do Jewish acts, you know, like praying or holidays or Shabbat rituals or Jewish study, or not doing them at all. Since the American Jewish community might well be the most self-obsessed subset of the entire population in the United States, we have now conducted many studies of ourselves. In nearly all of the most recent ones, the largest subset of American Jews say they are Reform Jews, perhaps as many as 40% of all American Jews. The last official study said about 35%, so we'll go with that. There are about 6 million American Jews, more or less, depending on whose definitions you accept and whose figures you rely on. If everyone who says they are Reform Jews actually belonged to Reform synagogues, that would translate to a membership of 2 million Reform Jews, then. In fact, we know the actual membership numbers for the Reform movement are fewer than 1 million affiliated people, meaning that at least one out of every two Jews who say they are Reform don't actually belong to a Reform synagogue. The next largest denomination in America is a bit confusing because it's made up of those Jews who say they have no denomination at all. That's about 30% of all U.S. Jews. Since they don't have to join a temple or organization to prove they aren't part of a denomination, that's close to 2 million totally unaffiliated Jews. In effect, the largest subset that actually means something. It's worth noting that it's now entirely possible, even popular in some quarters, to simply hire Jewish clergy or teachers online to prepare for and hold life cycle ceremonies like bar and bat mitzvah, weddings, funerals. Synagogues, under these circumstances, become ancillary, even unnecessary for the experience. The next largest segment is conservative Judaism, about 18% of the U.S. Jewish population, although again, a much smaller number actually affiliate with conservative congregations than those who say they're conservative, a bit over half of the number that say they're conservative, so about 600,000 Jews affiliate conservative. 10% of American Jews are Orthodox. Unsurprisingly, most of those indeed do affiliate with Orthodox synagogues, although the numbers on Orthodox affiliation are less clear than Reform or Conservative for administrative and institutional reasons. In a change that is fairly recent, perhaps only in the last 10 or 20 years, about 60% of those who identify as Orthodox Jews in America say they are Haredim, ultra-Orthodox, which would include many of those who participate at Chabad congregations. Interestingly, Orthodox Jews are younger and much more likely to be married than non-Orthodox Jews, whether Reform, Conservative, non-denominational, Reconstructionist, or Renewal affiliated. Again, not surprisingly, Orthodox Jews have more children than non-Orthodox Jews, and therefore their share of the U.S. Jewish population is rising. And while only about 50% of Jews raised Orthodox actually stay that way, when you calculate the much higher marriage and birth rates, that does point to a trend towards Orthodoxy in contemporary American Judaism, and a trend that is likely to continue to accelerate. In one way, the long-standing prediction that American Jews would become non-denominational has come true, at least in part. Nearly a third of American Jews no longer connect their Jewish identity with any movement or denomination. Movement affiliation has become far less strong among congregants at most U.S. synagogues. But in another sense, that prophecy missed a crucial point, which is that the U.S. Jewish population continues to become slowly but steadily more Orthodox. The overall number of Jews in America is not growing. It may in fact be shrinking a little, but the Orthodox, and in particular the ultra-Orthodox proportion, is growing, both through natural growth, attracting newly observant Jews, and through the aging and gradual shrinking of the other movements' base demographics. Another interesting trend is that even for those who belong to congregations within the Reform and Conservative movements, there's more diversity than ever before existed in services, music, educational tastes, even style. Being part of one congregation does not necessarily mean that another congregation of the same movement is particularly similar or perhaps even acceptable to you. So it's not at all clear that American Judaism has truly become post-denominational in character, even after 30 or more years of elaborate discussions about the subject. But it would be accurate to say that Jewish experience in the U.S. has become pluralistic in nature, and that the trend towards individual choice has only accelerated and probably will continue to do so. In other words, we are choosing more and more as Jews to choose what we want or don't want to bother with. It's unlikely that tendency is going to do anything but intensify in 2020 and every year thereafter. To play us in this morning, we have Amir Dadon's song, Or Gadol, A Great Light, about learning what really matters. כי בסוף כשזה נגמר יש סיבה לכל דבר לבד בתוך כל הטירוף אני חושב איך שהזמן יכול לעוף אבל בסוף כשזה נגמר יש סיבה לכל דבר אור גדול מאיר הכל ויותר כבר לא צריך לשאול אני בא ללמוד ממה שטוב ולחיות להתחיל הכל מההתחלה כמו לנשום בפעם הראשונה אני כאן אני לא מתבזבז That was Israeli singer Amir Dadon's song, Or Gadol, A Great Light. Our guest this morning is Heather Dune Makadim, author of the bestseller Rina's Promise, who has a new book out in time for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It's called 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Transport to Auschwitz. It reads like a novel, but it's not. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish Art guests this morning. Heather Dune McAdam is the author of the new book, 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz, a great work of scholarship and creativity. She's also the author of Rena's Promise, Story of Sisters in Auschwitz, a highly successful memoir about the 716th woman in Auschwitz. She has expanded on that, returned to that, and, well, tell us how you decided to write 999.
Oh, gosh. It's an incredible journey. I was living in Europe at the time, and I realized that it was the 70th anniversary of the first transport leaving from Poprad, Slovakia, and I decided to go. And I arrived in Slovakia, and in the West, this is a very little-known event, that the first Jewish transport, first official Jewish transport, was out of Slovakia to Auschwitz. And I arrived in Slovakia, and it was commemorative ceremony, like huge. The Prime Minister of Slovakia was there, the President of Slovakia. It was a really big event. And there's a plaque at the train station that I was traveling with my husband, and we discovered it. We arrived in Poprad. We discovered this plaque at night, and there were flowers and lights and all of these, stones. And I left. I was carrying with me a list of survivors that I knew were on the transport that I had collected with the help of the USC Shoah Foundation. But I also knew some women that were on the transport because of Rena, and those were women who did not survive. And I had their name on that list. And I left that list underneath the plaque with a stone and a candle. And within 24 hours, 48 hours, it was like, it was like a day and a half later, I heard from the family of the girl, Adela Gross, who Rena saw go to the gas chamber, and Rena knew her. And 70 years later, the family found out what had happened to their cousin and the surviving family. And that moment catapulted me into the story, because I realized how many other people are out there with lost girls. And I put a form up on my website saying, if you know anybody who was in the first transport, if your mother was, or, contact me. And people started emailing me. And I started getting photographs and stories. And then I met Edith Grossman, who is now 95, and she lives in Toronto, Canada. But I went back for the 75th anniversary of the first transport, which is on March 25th. And I met Edith in Poprad, conducted an interview, filmed the interview. I thought I would create a documentary. And Edith and I clicked just like Rena and I had. We're just very, very, very close. And I, Edith was able to fill in a lot of blanks around the beginning of the story. So for me, that's what I'm most fascinated with. Generally, we all know sort of what happened in Auschwitz, right? Like, because there's loads and loads of literature on that, and it's very chronicled. But the collection, the political background behind this first transport really fascinated me, and I found outrageous. And so I really wanted to unpack that for my reading public, because nobody's really looked into this.
And we will explore that. We're going to return in just a moment here on Two Jewish with Heather Dune McAdam. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has moved to larger quarters in our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, for Shabbat evening celebration services. 6:30 p.m. on Fridays, Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our new synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, just at the entrance of the Foothills Mall property. We're not in the mall, but in the south side on our own building, and we'll be there for a while. Join us at 2270 West Ina Road this Friday night at 6:30 p.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school, Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, all of our great services with wonderful music, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us as very popular Apple iTunes Store podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. My friends, I learned a new prayer for the new year. It's called the Jewish Serenity Prayer. It goes like this. God, grant me the senility to forget the people I never liked anyway, the good fortune to run into the ones that I do, and the eyesight to tell the difference. From our two Jewish mouths to God's ears, obviously. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been surveying some films the last couple of weeks that had Holocaust themes. The film The Two Popes, which is a really interesting movie, I wouldn't say it's a Holocaust film, but it certainly has important elements about that within it.
It definitely has Holocaust themes, and I think it's one of the best movies I've ever seen. So I highly recommend it to your listeners. I will say that for anybody who doesn't already know this, The Two Popes is a film about the current pope and the history of his relationship with his immediate predecessor, who was Cardinal Ratzinger from Germany. And the current pope, as everyone knows, is from Argentina. And the two nations could hardly be more different culturally, linguistically, whatever. Often World Cup rivals in soccer.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is brought up in the movie.
One of the best World Cup finals was Argentina-Germany not too
right.
long ago.
The current pope is, in fact, a huge soccer fan. So the movie was very well made and very well acted. Anthony Hopkins plays the German pope. But its relationship to the Holocaust is sort of twofold. The two men start as rivals because they're both candidates to be pope, but the Argentinian really doesn't want the job and is quite happy to see the German elected by the College of Cardinals. And at some point submits his resignation. He no longer wants to be a cardinal. He just wants to be a simple village priest. And part of that is by way of doing atonement for what he characterizes as his own sins in a very dark period of Argentinian history in the 1970s, when there was a military junta
with which
he cooperated to a minimal extent in order to guarantee the survival of priests and the church as an important institution in Argentina. And then he wonders if he compromised too much and if he sinned and tries to get forgiveness from the people. Anyway, there's a lot of that, but Ratzinger's involvement was in World War II, and there's much less overt introspection about his past. It's just sort of shadowy speculation as to what his involvement may have been. But the German church, the Catholic Church in Germany, doesn't have a very good record in this regard, and it's pretty well known. The two men also exchange a lot of, as they build this incredible friendship, I mean, some people call this movie a bromance, as they build this deep friendship, they talk about, how does God speak to us? How does he direct us? What is our calling? And devoting life to the church, particularly when that requires celibacy and a lot of other things, there used to be a vow of poverty, which clearly they don't take anymore, at least not on that high level, involves a lot of sacrifice. And they talk about why they made that sacrifice and what they gave up for it. And it's a very moving movie on many levels. And for me personally, it reminded me of the time a very senior church official in my work in Vienna, because I was the only guy who quoted from the Old Testament regularly every time I spoke to a high-level meeting. The representative of the Vatican took me aside once and very seriously said, if you would convert, we would make you a cardinal. It's the best bribe I ever said no to.
Cardinal Price. I kind of like that. I don't know. It's I don't know if it's as good as the name Cardinal Sin, who was a real cardinal, but it's pretty good. Cardinal Price. I like that. Right. Well, Tom, it didn't happen, but it's a great story. I have to say, that question about how does God speak to us reminds me of a bishop here in Tucson, Bishop Manuel Moreno, may he rest in peace, who was a friend of mine, and I went to lunch with him, and he said, so what are you doing for your own spiritual life? Not how are you leading your congregation, or what are we working on together? Such an interesting thing, because so often in Judaism, we don't really talk about that, to be honest.
Right.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Inbal Shtivi, from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker Ol.
So one of the experiences of being here in America as an Israeli is something you probably don't have too many other places. You were in Trader Joe's the other day. Tell me the story that you tell us the story that you told me all here.
No, it is an experience. We've been here for just over 5 months, me and my family. It's me, my husband, and my two children. And yeah, we're all around the city having fun, going to Sabino Canyon, going to Trader Joe's, going everywhere people go to buy stuff, to travel. And everybody's been extremely welcoming. We're walking, we're entering Trader Joe's, speaking Hebrew to each other. Israelis, we speak a bit louder. We are less restrained.
That's for sure.
Yeah, I found that even me, I'm less restrained than any other person here. and then, you know, people will just come to you asking that you speak Hebrew to them, that you say something from the Bible, that you will... We did. We actually said, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. And she... Yeah, and this woman at Trader was just almost... She was just not believing
she
herself.
Blessed.
Yeah, she just... Yeah, she thanked us dearly, of course. But yeah, somehow it's a bit different of an experience. We're feeling that we're kind of... The Jewish community, of course, I didn't see the entire community being so aware of Israel and Israeliness and our culture and so intrigued and so welcoming to us. Yeah, so that's
the
experience.
You're representing a culture, you're representing a country, and you're representing
And Israel is a celebrity. Israel is a celebrity country, is a celebrity culture. It's a celebrity religion. It's Jewish. It's and many people know about it, so many things. Many people have experiences with it, either travel or they met someone or they were with someone. So it's,
Well, it's nice to have you as a celebrity here.
It's the country that it's the celeb.
We'll talk next week. Toda
rabah.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benjamin rushes to the doctor. Doctor, you got to give me something to make me young again. I've got a date with a beautiful young woman tonight. His doctor said, hold on. You're 75 years old. There's really not a lot I can do for you. Benjamin replies, but doctor, my friend Tony's much older than I am, and he says he has sex 3 times a week. Okay, says the doctor. So you say it too. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and you say it too. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, young representatives of Israel here for the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So one of the startling differences is the way we eat in America compared to how you guys eat in Israel.
You eat all the time. You can't stop eating. You wake up, breakfast. Okay, after an hour, snack. Lunch, snack. Dinner, snack. All the time. Snack, snack, snack. And of course, we have the snacks in front of us. So of course, we gained weight because
it's
snacks all the time.
Guys, I know.
And Danielle this morning torn her pants.
Uh-oh.
I blame the Americans.
Yeah, blame the Americans. You get yourself on the scale. It's like America's at fault.
Oh, my God.
By the way, you're not alone in this experience. Every single Shinshinit. Thank you.
Every girl. That's the thing, you know, it's a very, very interesting observation.
The girls gain weight and the guys don't so much. Yeah.
That's unfair.
It
but I go to the gym all the time.
I think it's a metabolism thing. I can't really explain it. But I have a group of confirmation kids. They're all boys. I don't know why. We have like 6 boys. That's just how it worked out. There's no girls in that group. And I bring food. And whatever I bring is gone by the end of the hour. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be fresh. It's gone. So besides the fact that Americans snack all the time, and Israelis really don't, you eat meals, but you don't really snack.
We eat fresh food. That's the difference. I mean, everything we eat is fresh vegetables, fresh fruits. Everything is homemade. And here, I mean, I have never eaten a store-bought salad sauce until I got here. My mom is known for her salad sauce. Seriously, my friends come.
How
they
hard
ask
is it to make salad dressing?
And
oil and vinegar.
Like
you got a salad
and
dressing.
Pour it in. Yeah. No, that's not how you do it.
Yeah,
no,
you buy it in a bottle.
My host family, they make the best dressing. I have to say that.
But that's the only family I've heard. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, okay. That's all right. No, that's okay. I just want you both to be on the microphone.
Yeah.
All right. So also, Israel is a startup nation. America is a snack nation. No, but for real, like for example, in the Scouts. So we had twice a week. 2 hours activities every day, and maybe you have breaks, you have a morale, you have something all together. Any snacks? Zero snacks.
And we
went through it successfully. So
you didn't die.
We didn't
starve to death.
We survived and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
but here you just have to push it to everywhere, and
it's the strangest thing. You have a class of kids for like 45 minutes, and then they need a snack. Like,
you don't deserve a snack. You haven't done anything.
You haven't accomplished anything yet. Yeah. You haven't learned anything. When do I get a snack?
And I don't blame the kids. I mean, it's the adult's fault. It's like, okay,
yeah, it's probably
we
your
have
fault.
To pause now. The kids need to have their snack. No, you need to have your snack. They don't blame it on the kids.
Yeah, I think that's kind of true.
Yeah.
All right, so like besides our addiction to snacking and snack foods, you mentioned something about Vina, about cheese.
My mom is dairy-free. My mom's allergic, so I was raised and I didn't have too much cheese. I didn't consume it so much. But here, again, they put it on everything. We talked about how you barely eat any vegetables, so unless it's not topped with cheese, you probably won't eat it. But like, it's an excuse for everything. Let's put cheese on this. Let's put cheese on that. But no, you don't need cheese on everything. No, it's just, I don't like the taste of cheese.
All right, well, I can understand that. And I will say, in our defense, the vegetables in Israel are much better.
They're
fresher. They come to the table quicker. There's some of that in America. But if you want, the first cucumber or tomato that you eat in Israel, and you're like, oh, that's what it's supposed to taste like. So
yeah,
not like plastic.
Right? Yeah, it shouldn't taste like plastic. It shouldn't taste generic. It should taste like something.
You can eat it without cheese, too.
And you can eat it without cheese. Although, by the way, Israel has fantastic cheese,
but
too.
Like fresh cheese.
Fresh
it's cheese, not like the yellow right. weird one. It's good.
You mean the processed American cheese food?
Exactly.
Thanks, guys. We will talk next week.
Bye-bye, Labriel.
Don't snack too much. And now a word of Torah. This week we continue the narrative, the greatest story ever told, the real greatest story ever told, the tale of God and Moses liberating our people from slavery to freedom. The Torah portion of Vayera continues a dramatic showdown between Pharaoh, God King of Egypt, and the real God. Vayera is filled with the power of the supernatural. God brings plagues on Egypt that cause untold suffering, not just to lordly Pharaoh, but to the ordinary Egyptian folks living their ordinary lives. The stakes rise continually. In a narrative that builds in power, plagues strike one after the other. Pharaoh several times agrees to free the Israelites, only to repeatedly welch on the deal. At the end of our portion this week, we have the sense that it's all building to a climax, which we will indeed see in next week's even more dramatic tale of the actual exodus from slavery to freedom. In our time, we have seen the might and terror of many natural disasters, such as the Australian wildfires burning up much of that great continent right now. We understand our own powerlessness in the face of such destruction. Without comparing the divine role in each, we can still understand the message of our portion. We are not the ones truly in control. The power and command belong only to God. When Pharaoh rails against that simple fact, he is foretelling our own modern and postmodern need to pretend that we are really the ones in charge. And yet, it's simply not so. When we, like Moses, acknowledge God's power and control over nature, when we come to understand that it's all really in God's hands, well then, we, like Moses, can come to accomplish that which our hearts really desire. When we return, our guest, Heather Dune McAdam, will tell us some stunning things about the beginning of the first transport to Auschwitz, just in time for the 75th anniversary of its liberation. Find out what they are when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Buck Henry, the screenwriter and director who earned an Oscar nomination for his script for the 1967 classic film The Graduate, died last week at 89 years of age.
Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Buck Henry was born Henry Zuckerman in 1930. The Graduate, starring Dustin Hoffman, directed by Mike Nichols, both Jewish, of course, won Mike Nichols an Oscar for Best Director, and it has become an icon of American film. Buck Henry was nominated for another Oscar in 1979 for co-directing the movie Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty. Prior to his work in film, Henry worked on a number of TV shows in the 1960s, including co-creating the parody series Get Smart, along with Mel Brooks. Buck Henry also successfully hosted Saturday Night Live several times in the late 1970s. Henry was born to a Jewish family in New York. His mother, Ruth, was a silent film star, his father an Air Force officer. Buck Henry attended Dartmouth, serving in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. May his memory be a blessing, and may his remarkable scripts and comedy live on. Former NBA star Amari Stoudemire called for an end to anti-Semitism among African Americans last week. Amari Stoudemire said he wanted to address the situation that happened in Muncie with the brother that had the attacks on the Jewish people, anti-Semitic attacks. He made a video statement that continued, "One thing we got to realize is that African Americans are also Semitic people, being that they are from the lost tribes of Israel. So therefore, if you have any anti-Semitic comments, you're actually showing your ignorance because you're speaking out against yourself. Secondly, for you to attack someone who's trying to keep the ordinance of God, who's trying to keep the commandments, trying to really reach a high level of righteousness, for you to attack someone in that manner shows another level of ignorance. So therefore, it's unacceptable to have anti-Semitic slurs or any hate crime, especially if you are a man of God. Stoudemire identifies with the Hebrew Israelites, African Americans who believe they are connected to the biblical Israelites, and he observes Jewish holidays. He's in the process of an Orthodox conversion to Judaism. Amari called on Jews to stay strong in your faith and your belief in Israelites. Do not allow this to be something that hinders your belief. Stay strong, teach peace and love, and continue to grow as a people. Amari Stoudemire also played for the professional Israeli team Hapoel Yerushalayim. And finally, every other week as Shabbat approaches the Dutch city of Groningen, another more mundane ritual takes place. A group of self-appointed volunteers begin calling around and texting friends on WhatsApp. They are confirming the attendance of fellow members of the Jewish community at that week's Saturday morning service. Amid growing fears of violent anti-Semitism following several attacks on Jewish institutions across Europe, the Groningen Synagogue, like many others across the continent, now operates behind fortified defenses in a nearly covert fashion. The community has an emergency plan in case of attack. Local police keep watch on site during services. It doesn't publish details of its services, relying instead on worshippers to keep each other informed of the schedule and muster up attendance in private chat groups and over the phone. Members are trained to vet visitors at the entrance. For an outsider, the congregation in Groningen has become easy to overlook, and that's partly the point. Alec Farber, 18 years old, who moved to Groningen to study from New York, missed a number of holy days before he realized the congregation actually existed. He finally gained entry to a service after making friends with other Jewish students. He had to bring ID and flag his arrival in advance. It was actively difficult, Farber said about the process. Back in the U.S., he says, my synagogue posts every service on its website. For many, the difficult logistics are a small price to pay to keep the congregation safe from the type of violent attacks that have devastated other Jewish communities recent years. Groningen Jewish community is also wary of an increased normalization of hate speech across Europe. Given the family ties and connections between communities in different countries there, the effect of an attack reverberates. Members of the Groningen congregation knew people caught in the 2015 shooting at the Great Synagogue of Copenhagen and in the recent attack in Halle in Germany on Yom Kippur, in which a 27-year-old far-right terrorist live-streamed himself besieging a synagogue and killed two people. The incident in Halle was a turning point, warned David Gurov, a 20-year-old student originally from Cologne, whose friend was barricaded in the German synagogue as gunmen tried to force his way in. History is getting forgotten, he said, and the layer that was holding back anti-Semitism from growing has been breached. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Heather Dune McAdam, has a new book, 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz, kind of right in time for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. A lot of people see that as the beginning of the end of the Holocaust. The beginning of Auschwitz is chronicled quite carefully in your book. By the way, she's also the author of Rena's Promise, which led, as we heard earlier in the show, to the creation of this book as well. You know, I think the... Boy, you talk about how chronicling how it all started and the political and practical machinations that led to the creation of Auschwitz, where, oh, perhaps a million people were murdered.
Yeah. A million Jews.
A million Jews, rather. Maybe
1 million, Jews, yeah. And then there's the gypsies and the homosexuals and the
political prisoners and so on.
Exactly.
The Jews on that original transport, all girls, just under 1,000 of them, 999, which is the title of the book, were actually sold by their government. Can you explain how that happened?
You know, and it's not even sold. It was so hard to find a term for this. So, you know, in slavery, right, you buy and sell your slaves, human beings, you buy and sell them. But this was actually the government paid the Nazis
to take away
their Jews. To take their girls and to take their Jews. the Slovak government, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I know it was like 500,000, something like that, in the first year, 1942, paid the Third Reich for all of the deportations of the Slovak Jews out of the country. And as one of my witnesses says, on the agreement that the deportated would not come back.
Wow.
And they used this lovely term, rehoming. We're going to rehome you, which meant kill you. It became sort of an issue, like, how do I actually describe this? Because it, in one sense, it is actually slave labor, right? Except they were going to be worked to death. So generally, if you're, you know, buying a commodity, you don't necessarily just
destroy it deliberately.
Yeah, but this was actually deliberate. And, you know, and the Nazis were actually being paid to do that, which is really so despicable, right? And so horrifying to me when I discovered that. And I did spend a lot of time with one of the foremost scholars of the first transport, Dr. Pavel Meshton, who lives in Bratislava. He's the director of the Museum of Jewish History in Bratislava, Slovakia. And he is just a wealth of information around all of this, and he has all of these documents. He actually has in his office a copy of the charges, the Third Reich chart, how much the Slovak government had to pay the Third Reich for getting rid of their Jews.
How did it turn out that they were all girls, young women?
This is a mystery, and part of that mystery is, I believe, is in the lost transcripts of the Wannsee Conference. The Wannsee Conference happened about, I think it's about 6 weeks before the first transport, and there is all this conversation about, you know, how are we going to organize the final solution. And I believe that there had to have been a discussion about women that has been expunged from the historic record. Dr. John Roth, who's a wonderful historian on women in the Holocaust, says quite truthfully, if you want to destroy a race of people, what do? You get rid of women. They're the bearer, they're the nurturers and the bearers of the race. And they did target unmarried women, right? Virgins. These are virgins. 16 up to 32, although there were some older women, a few older women in the transport. So it's very, very targeted towards genocide. And the other part of that is that it was more likely that families would give up their daughters than their sons. They were lied to. They were told, you know, oh, your daughter's going to go work for 3 months in a shoe factory, a munitions factory. They told them that by going, they would be supporting their family. Since Jews could no longer really hold down work and everybody was starving, the girls were sort of eager to go and support their families. And I think for me, the most chilling moment is that, you know, the girls, when they were getting on buses and passenger trains to go to this holding area in Poprad, which was actually an army barrack, they sang the Slovak national anthem. They sang folk songs. They joked. They were all excited about going. They thought they were serving their country. And it is just such an act of betrayal to innocence. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And nobody knew that was the last time they were going to see their parents, for many of them.
I have a different question. How mm-hmm. did you end up becoming so deeply involved in this story and in telling these stories?
I really connect to these young women, and I guess it's because I was a young woman. And I feel like as an older woman, it is my duty now to protect the younger generation from the horrors of an abusive patriarchy. And my heart is grabbed by the story. And I also feel I get sort of into self-righteousness that they've been ignored. You know, you can look in history books and you'll see mention that it's the first transport on arriving at Auschwitz on March 26, 1942. And they don't say it was all full of young women. And it's like, well, why aren't you saying that? Why are you ignoring it? It's a fact. And you know, it feels like a real, I take it very personally. It feels like a slight to womankind. Because if these girls survive, like Edith did, they survived longer than any Jewish man in Auschwitz. Because the men did not arrive until the end of April, on the fifth transport to Auschwitz.
In 1942.
Transports were all women. All women, yeah. Except for one from Slovakia. There was one coming from France, from Drancy, that was all men. But from Slovakia, the first four transports were all young women.
So I'm going to go back one more time. I mean, you danced with Martha Graham. You did so many interesting things. Now this has become such a deep focus. What really triggered this originally?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. I'm a big reader. I was a speed reader when I was younger. And I was a professional dancer. I studied music. I had a lot of energy. Dance sort of took all that energy. And when I did injure my back, and I couldn't walk for 2 weeks. And my best friend, I was living in New York at the time on Canal Street, and a Chinese in Chinatown and very 80s. And my roommate was working in audio publishing, and she said, Why don't you do some work for me since you can't move? So I started writing scripts, and I found a voice, and I loved writing. It's another way of expressing myself artistically, So I think it was already in there. My aunt was a writer. I come from a family of artists, painters. And musicians, and so it was just sort of finding a way of expression. It doesn't really matter how I express myself as long as I'm doing something to express myself.
And then you came on Rena's story, and the rest is
all
led
history.
To this.
I mean, Rena, I tell this very sweet story. So the first time Rena called me, and it was just a friend said, oh, you should talk to Heather, a friend who knew Rena. So Rena calls me up, first time I ever speak to her, and when Rena starts talking, you can't... can't get off the phone, right? So it was like an hour of, like, you know, she speaks so fast, talking at me. And I finally go, Rena, I have to go get dinner, but I'm going to drive up and meet you in Asheville. I was living in North Carolina at the time. Mm-hmm. And she says, what are you having for dinner? I said, I'm having pierogi. And she said later that was a sign from God. I was eating Polish pierogies for dinner.
In writing 999, just one last question. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest surprise that you encountered? What was the shock?
All right. There's a few. But after working with Rena really intensely, and Rena told me things that I was sworn to secrecy on, and even with all of that, when I started to go through the USC Shoah Foundation visual archives and listen to testimonies, time and again I heard survivors from the first transport mention the selections, which everybody knows that there were selections, and the, you know, men and women had to stand, and they would, you know, the thumb would go left or right, and you know, one way was the gas and the other way was back to camp, and it would take all day. Horrifying. I once figured out it was like you stood in front of the SS for like 2 seconds, 2.3 seconds or something while they made a decision. The thing that was really, really shocking is that I hear in these testimonies that they were naked. They had to take their clothes off and stand there all day long. And on Shabbat Hanukkah, on December 5th, 1942, there is mention in the historic record of 2,000 women going to the gas, and I believe the SS records are incorrect in that, because I have witnesses, including Rudolf Verba, who escaped from Auschwitz and is a, you know, very valid witness, as well as women who were standing there, including Rena. All, you know, independent of each other, say 10,000 women were selected for the gas that day. And it was a freezing, freezing cold day. They were forced to stand all day long, stark naked, in the snow. And Linda Reich, one of the survivors whose USC Shoah testimony I use, says that when she came back to her block, out of 1,000 girls in that block, there were 20 left. And on that day, Edith's sister, Leah, was ill, and she was taken and killed. So there's two things that shock me. One, that women were forced to stand naked in snow. I mean, you know, all day. I mean, how do you survive that? And the second is that I've been questioned about my primary source on that. And I have to say, who do we believe? The SS or witnesses? The SS are, you know, they have a reason to lie about how many women were selected. Sure. And the numbers in December don't match. They don't match.
And the Germans are meticulous about having numbers
match. They're
very
meticulous. However, and this is the other thing that I state over and over and over again in the book, there's a book called The Auschwitz Chronicle that was collected by Danuta Cech, and it's the day-to-day workings of the Auschwitz, and it's a horrifying book. You know, how many people killed, how many people came in a transport, the numbers, they were tattooed. It's very meticulous. She says over and over and over again in the book, she says this many men were dead from that transport by August such and such. We do not have the same records for women. Women's death records were not kept until August 1942. So when Edith and Rena arrived in March, there is a spike in death records in the camp itself, and then it drops. And then there's no, the death records are, you know, it's all men. So we don't know how many women died between March 1942 and August 1942.
But yet another indignity.
Yet another indignity.
I want to thank Heather Dune McAdam for a great visit here on Two Jewish. The book is $9.99, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz. It reads really like a thriller. It's a great read, but incredible information. Thank you so much. And where can people go to?
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Where can people go to find out more about you and about your book?
We have two websites. One is 999thebook.com. And there's information about the documentary film that I'm making to pair with the movie that will have, I have to add one more thing. Last week, I found another survivor. She's 96, and she's living in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've already been on the line with her, so I'm going to fly to Australia to interview her. And that will be for the documentary. I want to make sure that these stories are chronicled for film as well as literature.
Thank you again. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest next week will be Ellen Frank, an artist of the Cities of Peace Project, who is creating a gold leaf picture of the liberation of Auschwitz. It should be fascinating. Our playout this morning comes from Eyal Golan, Melech Malchei Hamlachim, King of All Kings, a song to God. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week we pray of peace.
סלח לי אבי כי חטאתי לך מחולי על כל פשעי גם בימים ששכחתי אותך היית תמיד בחיי בכל הדרכים שהלכתי בעצם היית לי נר לרגלי הייתי עיוור לא ראיתי מעבר
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.